Hello, I'm your host, Leonard Duncan. Welcome to a new episode of ATV Talk and Motorsports Podcast. Please join us every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. We bring you interviews with industry professionals, live events, live news about the motorsports industry in every episode. Enjoy the show. Whether we are out riding with our friends and family or racing in extreme environments, we all need good tires. That's why I recommend GBC Power Sports Tires, a division of Greenball Corp. Their products, which include XC Master, Mini Master, and Groundbuster 3, are what leading professionals in the ATV-UTV industry are using. You can get your tires at greenballtires.com or find them on Instagram as GBC Tires for further inquiry. Are you looking for the best suspension technology for your sport ATV? Look no further than Elka Suspension, the industry leader in sport ATV suspension technology. With championship wins in prestigious events such as the Dakar Rally, SCORE, Best in the Desert, ATV MX, Cross Country, and Works, Elka Suspension has established itself as the go-to choice for athletes and enthusiasts alike. But they don't just stop at ATVs. They're constantly expanding into new markets, including UTVs, trucks, SUVs, pit bikes, snowmobiles, and more. Their commitment to innovation and quality means they're always looking to improve and adapt so you can enjoy a smooth ride wherever you go. Want to learn more about what Elka Suspension can do for you? Visit their website at elkasuspension.com. or give them a call at 450-655-4855. They will always be happy to answer your questions and help you find the perfect suspension solution for your needs. Mike Seeger, welcome to ATV Talk. How's it going, brother?
It's going good, man. How about yourself?
Oh, I cannot complain at all. Well, I'm living a dream.
Yeah. That's exactly what I say all the time. Just living the dream. Just living the dream.
You know, I can't believe that I actually have gotten paid to work on ATVs most of my life.
Yeah. I wouldn't say it was most of my life for my, you know, little endeavor that I have going on here, but it's been a good last few years, that's for sure.
So let's get into it just a little bit.
Yeah.
You do the work on Cody Collier's 4x4?
Yes.
So how did that all take place?
So Cody and I had a mutual friend by the name of Justin Wood. The Billy Goat, you know, we still talk. He actually rides back and forth to us to races. And Justin was getting out of it. And Justin ended up selling a quad to Mark, which is Cody's dad. And it was going to be a practice quad for Cody. And Justin looked at Mark and he said, if you want Cody to win championships, then you're going to have to let Michael wrench on the quad. And then it was kind of one of those things to where, you know, I was approached by Mark. He let me know everything. And it was only, a couple races that we had at the end, I think, of 2021. And yeah, because Cody was 22 and 23 champion, so 2021. And Mark came up to me, if I remember, it was the GNCC Buckwheat, and says, "We want you on for all year next year." And that's kind of where, you know, where it all began with the relationship between the Colliers and, you know, myself and everybody. I started this whole thing just to really offset the cost of racing. It was, at the time, you know, I would work on, you know, good friends, quads and different things, but it was never to, you know, make money or, you know, have a business out of it or anything else like that.
And now you have a business out of it?
Yeah. We've been, We've been running KMK pretty much, which we started KMK back in 2016, I think it was. But it was just a small concept whenever I'd done it, and it was for Polaris Razors, the side-by-sides. And it was whenever the 1000s and everything, they were having voltage regulator issues, and they mounted them, Polaris ended up mounting them on the bottom of the body. And I actually made a relocation harness that put them underneath the hood. And that's where I kind of got the whole LLC thing started. And then, you know, that worked out for a couple of years. And then, you know, Polaris ended up, you know, moving it up underneath the hood. And it just lay dormant, you know, for a while until, you know, I started racing myself. So.
Okay. Where did it come to be with building 4x4s, or are you a sport quad guy?
So I never was a sport quad guy. We always, you know, I had the old, you know, Honda Foreman, right? You know, the 450 and everything. And whenever I was young, that was my mode of transportation. You know, we were out on it every weekend. I think I had 11 or 12,000 miles on that quad.
Jeez.
And yeah, it was, you know, it was a tank. And so I was always accustomed to, you know, the 4x4s and different things. And I had somebody call me one day from a dealership that says, hey, we have a deal you can't refuse. And I'm like, well, what's your deal? And they said, well, we have a Polaris Scrambler here, 1000. A farmer had it, and his grandson ended up ripping a whole lower A-arm off of it. And it was, he said, for us to do it, we have to, you know, legitimately do a frame swap on it. And he doesn't want to do that. He just wants to sell it outright. So I think I gave him, it was a 2016 Scrambler 1000. It had like 400 miles on it. I think I gave him $2,500 for it. And then... Oh. And then we ended up, I got it fixed. I welded a new A-arm tab on the front end of it. And in 2018, my first race was with New East Coast up here. And it was at High Point Raceway. And it was my first race that I really ever, you know, competed, especially with it being cross country. And ended up, you know, I think I placed 10th or something, but I did finish. I ended up finishing on a flat tire and everything else, and then after that, I was hooked. You know, that year, I had a bunch of great companies behind me. Rick Checo with Checo Racing, he ended up building me an entire frame for it because, you know, it takes a lot to keep a Polaris together. I feel it takes more to keep a Polaris together than it does to ever keep a Can-Am together. And I was a diehard Polaris fan. And then same dealership called me with another, I got a deal you can't refuse. And they took a Renegade 1000, a 2019 Renegade 1000 on trade. The guy didn't want it, had like 80 miles on it. And he called me and, It was at a smoking deal because they didn't want to have to deal with it. And I was in Oklahoma at the time with some work training and everything. And I said, just put it in the warehouse and I'll get it whenever I get back. And after I'd done that, you know, it was a night and day difference from just everything from the Can-Am to the Polaris. And that first year on that, you know, I really didn't do anything to the Can-Am as far as frame wise. And then whenever I decided we were going to go racing full time with GNCC, I ended up stripping it down to bare frame. And pretty much, you know, that was the end of it. And never really had any DNFs, and just ended up putting what I feel, you know, with a lot of help, you know, as far as, you know, because all my frames and everything right now, they have B&R Gussie kits on them. I get a lot of parts from B&R Motorsports out of North Lima, Ohio. And just they, you know, put together a real solid platform with the Can-Am for sure.
So let's get into that.
Yeah.
You get a machine. So, okay, Mike, you know, I don't know nothing. Here's my Renegade 1000. What do I got to do? I want to go and compete against Cody Collier and Brandon Frazier and Landon Wolf.
Yeah.
What's my platform and what's it going to take for you to work on this machine? I mean, do I got to frame it? Do I got to do motor work? What do I got to do?
So, you know, first we, you know, I go in and I strip them completely down to bare frame. They are nothing. Takes, believe it or not, I can get one down, taking my time in about 3 hours. And that's completely sitting there, everything off of it, everything put on the shelf, and it's a bare frame. From that point, we take them and we weld in a complete gusset kit from B&R. And that ends up triangulating a lot of the spaces on there that are prone to crack or prone to cracking. You really don't want to make them too stiff, right? Because they're just going to start cracking out in other places. So the frame does have a little bit of flex to it where it should have flex to it. And then after that, it goes to powder coat. Some companies, they don't really go down to bare frame as far as I do. They will go down to the point that they can, you know, weld in the gusset kits, and then they pretty much call it a day. I am the type of person to where, and I'm not saying anything's wrong with that at all, but I'm the type of person that everything has to be in order, and I want the frame color, you know, to match. I don't want anything to look out of place. Whenever it rolls out, you know, I don't want anybody to be able to say that's a gusseted frame. I want it to look completely factory, unless we're doing a wild build, you know, like the gold quad that we did for Cody, or, right, you know, something like that. But then, you know, we go and your preference of shocks. Cody's an Axis guy. I'm an Axis guy. But, you know, depending on budget, depending on other things, we end up doing revals from B&R. Which is a great alternative to you know, a full blown shock. So they'll take them in and, you know, they do their magic to the shocks, and you get them back and they're great. They really are. So it really goes for preference, you know, in the shock department. Lower A arms, Texera Tech is about the only, I'll say, is the only person right now, Ed is the only person right now that actually builds lower A arms for the 2019 platform. And I will say right now. So other than that, it, you know, other than little odds and ends, it's, you know, motor, we don't get into the motor unless we have to get into the motor. It's completely factory. They make enough horsepower. Seat cover, and then Can-Am, you know, they do have, Can-Am has a partnership with Twin Air, so you can buy the Twin Air kit from Can-Am directly. Just makes it a foam filter, just easy to clean and different thing else like that, especially if you're going to race. And then B&R does do our tuning on the ECU, and I wouldn't say it's so much for power, more than it raises some limits of like where it goes into limp mode for cooling. The fan kicks on sooner than it would, you know, normally, and it kicks off later than it would normally.
Right.
A Checo steering stem, you know, steering stem brace, and it's just a factory. It slides down into the factory stem. We don't really raise the bars. I know, you know, back in the old motocross days and everything else, it was a +2 stem, you know, on the steering stem and everything. Now we try to keep them as low as we possibly can.
Okay. So do you get into clutching? Is that something that's a preference from Cody, or is that something that you've worked out for them?
So we get into clutching, and it's not necessarily to squeeze out any more power. It's out of belt longevity. You know, I listened and watched Cody's you know podcast on here with you guys, and he is in a race scenario. It's just to try to keep that belt together for one race, and that's it. If the belt goes, you know, because we normally pull the belts after one race, I'll put them on the shelf. I'll write down, you know, what round it was, where Cody placed at. If it was a mud race, if it was, you know, sunny, dusty, you know, anything else, those type of conditions, I'll write on the paper of the belt. So that way I know. And then if Cody needs a belt for, you know, his practice squad or anything else like that, we just throw the one race belts on. Clutching, that is a, it is a B&R tuned secondary. That is, it's, it utilizes kindly a Maverick turbo secondary, which is a roller secondary versus what comes on them. Now they're not a roller. I mean, it's more of a, I can't really tell you what the right term for the secondary clutch that is used on it from the factory, but we do go to a roller clutch, which would be, you know, like your STMs or anything else like that. I ran STMs for the longest time. But I was nowhere near as fast as Cody or, you know, those top three guys in the pro class for sure.
What is it? What is, a 1000 cost off the showroom floor? Do you know?
Yeah. Actually I do. So before, you know, tax title and, you know, prep and everything else like that, they're 14.9, so I might as well say $15,000. If you end up paying tax, and like the dealership that I have a relationship with, they don't do prep for me. They leave it in the crate. So I don't, you know, Cody doesn't have that, or, you know, a customer of mine doesn't have that added charge because there's no sense in it. I'm going to tear it down anyway. So whenever I went to pick up Cody's the last, I put the battery in it. I slid the, you know, handlebars up. I done everything, and then I wheeled it out into, you know, put it in the trailer and took it home. And then it was about an hour before it started getting tore down. So,
and to take a machine like that for $15,000,
yep.
What else is their cost? So I'm going to buy some Texteratec,
yep,
arms. Do we change the axles?
No, all OEM axles, OEM wheel bearings, OEM hubs, OEM rotors. Everything primarily is OEM with them. I mean, we do swap out some things for longevity, right? If I'm in there, I might as well swap them. You know, we run garage products, AOM bushings. John Archer out there, he lives, you know, I think an hour or so away from me, does one hell of a bushing. Cody can go through an entire season and I don't have to worry about him, you know, wallowing out or, you know, wearing out or anything else like that. We use some steering stem bushings that the Can-Am is notorious for getting a little bit of steering slop, and that's primarily from the steering stem bushings in the steering stem and in the lower pitman arm. So we end up changing those out with an aftermarket company. I do some things, you know, with the pitman arm, not necessarily strengthening the pitman arm, but just the way that I put, you know, everything together with it. You know, Cody went an entire season last year, and we didn't have any loosening of tie rods, you know, after snowshoe or anything else like that. So it's one of the things that, you know, we try to keep to a minimum, especially with, you know, with Mr. Collier, that's for sure.
When you work on Cody's machines,
mm-hmm,
is he hard on them? You know, I knew, cause I worked on Ryder's machines where you go to the one race and you bring the thing back and it's just like beat to death and you start over. And then there's other guys that, you know, it's 4, 5, 6 races before you start seeing excessive wear or wear that could cause some type of failure.
Right. So, you know, we have, I can tell you from where Cody and I started to where we are today is Cody's a totally different person than he was, you know, 2 years ago. Cody has learned, you know, the machine, the do's and don'ts, what you can and you can't do. These are, you know, 1,000-pound pigs. I mean, essentially, you know, they will fly. They just don't like to. And if you don't know the limitations of that machine, you're going to be constantly going through parts. These front differentials, you know, it's the sudden jolt. Like whenever you're jumping one or you're going to hop a log or anything else like that, it is, you know, just the start and stop of that. It puts a shock through. And the way the Can-Am is set up, once when you're locked into four-wheel drive, you are a solid lock from the front to the from the rear to the front wheels. There's no slip joint in there. There's no nothing. It is a solid lock. So whenever you're braking or doing anything, you can use primarily your rear brakes, but it's going to slow your front down too, just because they're all interconnected at that point in time. Polaris, you can go ahead.
Is there a pressure valve so that you could make it have more brake front or rear in there like that or anything like that? Because I know in some vehicles, there's a system that you can make where as you apply brake, it could affect more of the front and less of the rear or something like that.
Yeah, there's no bias on the Can-Am. You know, not necessarily saying that you couldn't put a bias in there. But like I said, you know, once when you start slowing down the rears, then the fronts are going to, you know, ultimately start slowing down as well. Just because the way it locks in, a Polaris is totally different. A Polaris uses a Hilliard designed front end, which has a sprag in it and what they call cups. And everything works with electromagnets. So a Polaris, with their on-demand, will sense slip out of the rear wheels and it'll lock in the front versus how it thinks it needs it. Works great when it works.
I like that, when it works. Yeah. I like the technical portion of the conversation here. I really appreciate you getting in depth with me on this machine. There's probably people out there that are not as excited about it, but you look at this big monster that, okay, I'm thinking in my head, you know, I'm going to go deer hunting in the bush with this thing with racks and climb over rocks. And I'm going to be doing, you know, 7 miles an hour max speed. And then I watch these videos of these guys and I'm just utterly amazed at how nimble the machine is, how fast it is. And it just seems to handle the terrain so well. And you got to give it to Cody and Brandon and Landon. These guys are extremely talented to ride these like that.
Yeah, you know, those top three last year, whenever, you know, I had a conversation with Landon not too long ago, and it was amazing how last year those top three guys in some of the races were beating fourth place by over 6 minutes. You know, that and the way that they're going through the woods, like I'm watching, you know, Cody's footage from last race, and it's crazy the speed, because whenever I was racing, it was, how are these guys 4 minutes faster, 5 minutes faster a lap? Because I felt like I was flying, you know? And then it's just, you watch their footage, you know, Brandon, Landon, all of them, Cody, and then it's just amazing how they can thread them through trees the way that they do. And, you know, the crazy part about it is, though, is it, you know, they're inches away from a bad day. you know, going through those trees the way that they do. You know, I've had, so the new Can-Am has the bigger dash on it, which has a cool feature to where it'll give you average speed and it'll give you top speed. And normally Cody's, I will reset at the beginning of every race, so just so that way I can see. Average speed out of those guys is 28 miles an hour, which doesn't seem like it's really that fast, but, you know, navigating through the trees and everything else, it is. With the top speed that they're clicking, you know, 75, 80 mile an hour out of in some spots. And it is, it's crazy that, you know, we've got there.
That's pretty crazy. Let me shift gears a little bit on you. Yep. And we're going to go backwards into a machine that you don't, you probably still work on them, but they don't make it anymore. The 800. Cody yep. preferred the 800.
The 850.
How did you feel about it at the time when you knew that the 1000 was faster?
So a lot of people don't realize that the 850 and the 1000, they do have their, they're both have their advantages and disadvantages. They are pretty much identical machines as far as everything. There's a 15-pound difference in between the two. And that's it. And that's primarily from the transmission. They do not share the same transmission. The 1000 shares a larger transmission. The 850 is a larger bore, but a shorter stroke than the 1000. The 1000 is a smaller bore, but a longer stroke. So the 850 actually revved out quicker than the 1000. Out of the hole, the 850 is quicker than the 1000 if you go neck to neck, if they're both started and everything is, you know, completely the same. But where the 1000 shines is the fields. It's just got so much low end torque that I felt the spots that you were able to make up time in the woods on the 850 because you were able to keep it, you know, keep it throttled in longer, got lost in the woods. Snowshoe is a huge disadvantage on an 850 just because of the long ski slopes that it has. That 1000 will just outpower all day long and pass an 850 almost like it's sitting still on a ski slope.
So Cody goes as fast as he did on it. It was pretty amazing.
It was, you know, it was one of those things. But then, you know, you talk to Cody just like I talked to him at the end of round one, you know, and I said, "What'd you think about it?" He said, "I should have been on it the entire time." So, but for this weekend, we are breaking the 850 back out for Florida. So, the Apollo quad, which is the last year's championship quad, is going to go around Florida.
Could you give me a breakdown on what the theory behind that is? I know that Florida could chew up a new machine pretty rapidly because of the grit, but is that the only reason you're doing it, or do you want the 850 for a specific reason?
No, the only reason why, you know, God bless Cody and all of them, that four-wheeler is already prepped, right? And Florida and Georgia are back-to-back weekends, and it's about a 15-hour drive for me. And we will leave Saturday after the race and start heading back home just to turn around the next Thursday night to head back down. So getting a machine turned around that quick takes quite a bit, you know, to do. So it's just easier if we have two machines where they are back-to-back weekends. But that sand and everything, man, that black sand down in Palatka, it just gets everywhere.
Okay, I get it. That's, you know, so what you're telling me is that the rider that you're maintaining is smart enough to realize that he needs to help you by having that second machine available in that scenario.
Yep. So the way we run, you know, Cody's program is that last year's machine always goes on the shelf for the most part. It will come out for Georgia or Florida, and then I will bring it home and I will prep it. And then it won't come back out unless we need it. So it's always there as a backup, you know, because God forbid.
Does it go to every event?
No, no, no. It'll only go to an event that we need it at. Because, you know, unfortunately, once when they're done, there is no swapping four-wheelers. So, you know, you can't, you know, wrap one around a tree, limp it out of the woods, jump on a new fresh four-wheeler and go again. So by the time they, you know, do that, then we just leave it.
How does it make you feel? So, we have a short stint of this, but I want to ask your opinion. So, mm-hmm. you prep that machine, you've gone over it, you do your thing. Is there a section of time that you go test this machine, bring it back, wash it off, and it's ready to go? Or is it roll out of your garage, roll in the trailer, and it goes to the track?
There you go. It you know, gets washed. My son, Kane, he washes Cody's. He washes pretty much all the quads. But it'll come in. Like, I talk to Cody probably 3 to 4 times a week. You know, when it comes off the track, when everything's fresh on his mind, you know, I ask him, you know, the goods and the bads, what's going on with it. You know, like on the gold one, we tried a new horn setup, not a horn setup, but a horn placement, and which was a great idea in the beginning. You know, but after the race, Cody's like, I don't like the position of it. Let's just move it. I said, okay, you know, no big deal. And he said the, you know, the brakes were, you know, kindly spongy. So, you know, that tells me that, you know, that was all fresh, new fluid, new lines, new everything. I've just got air somewhere in it. And, you know, sometimes chasing air bubbles and brake lines is a task. Yeah. So, like, I brought that quad home. I rebled the brakes. I done everything Cody needed to do. And then, you know, it goes out. I do plug all the quads into the Can-Am software, so Buds, and just check and see if there's any problems that maybe he didn't know about, but, you know, something showed up. And, you know, because for me, and it's the same way whenever we build a new quad, it, you know, it goes in and it comes out, and other than me, you know, just kindly running it around the property and doing a couple heat cycles on it, it rolls out of the trailer and goes to the line. And
so there's no shakedown with your machines?
No. Nope.
So this is the way we used to do it in the old days, is we would roll the machine out, and if it was a desert race, we would go do a shakedown, you know, sometimes up to 30 miles.
Yep.
Just to get a feel for it, then come back, check the valves, change the oil, go through it. You know, just make sure that it's all fresh to go to the starting line. Some of your other models, we would do just, we had a little course in the parking lot that was, you could ride them pretty, I could ride them pretty damn hard.
Yeah.
Not all the guys could, but I could ride them hard. And we would just get a feel for them, and then, you know, you'd do your nut and bolt check and put it in the truck or the trailer, and you're off to go. When works started on the West Coast,
yep,
was roll it out of the truck, and you didn't get to ride it. There was no, you could ride it to the starting line, but there was no tune check. There was no nothing. You was just ride it to the starting line and go.
Yeah.
Does that ever make you nervous?
Oh man, yes. You know, I'm nervous every time. I mean, you look at, so, Miss Amy, you know, Cody's mom, we pit, you know, Cody together, amongst, you know, my other riders. So we're just a GNCC pit crew, and she says I'm more nervous than she is, right? You know, because for me, I can't help it if, you know, if a tree gets hit, it gets rolled over or anything else like that. But it would honestly make me rethink things if, you know, he came through and say, you know, they're in a battle and it's something that I forgot, you know, or if I, you know, I forgot to tighten this bolt or I forgot to do this. And so, yeah, you know, until till the race is over, I don't enjoy it, you know. So it's I'm a nervous person when it comes to that. And I mean, really, it's not just Cody. It's my other riders too. You know, I've got a rookie pro that's out there, Caden Worf, fast kid, phenomenal. And then Gavin Jenkins, he's on the pro road. I do some things for him. You know, I didn't build him a new machine over the winter, but I went through his old machine and we, you know, changed out things. And then I've got some A-class guys, you know, some B-class guys, and a C-class guy, you know, right now. All of them done very well, you know, last weekend. So it's kind of one of those things to where I try to give everybody the attention that, you know, they deserve. So it's pretty hectic, especially where this isn't my primary, you know, my primary means of income. This is a side hustle, if you would.
So your main job is not building and prepping these machines?
No, it's not. I manage an oil and gas company up here in Pennsylvania during the day.
How do you have the time to work on ATVs?
Man, you get efficient. That's how it is. You get efficient. You know, it's a thing to where, you know, my son will come over and he washes every one of them for me. My wife helps out with, you know, the billing and different things. And I've got a guy that comes in and he works at a dealership as a tech down there at a dealership. And I have him come in and, you know, get the quad completely stripped down and naked, and he'll change the oil and do things else like that. And then I'll step in, you know, retort, do, you know, a tip to tail check on all the nuts, bolts and everything. And then he'll, you know, put the plastics back on, and then, you know, we wash them one more time, spray them down with, you know, a detailer and load them in the trailer.
Really?
Yep.
And how long does that, from start to finish, adding the wash time, how long, and let's just say average, because I know a mud race could be longer.
Yeah, man. So, like, this past weekend at Big Buck, it wasn't really muddy. You know, there was dirt on them. They wasn't overly muddy or anything else like that. My son probably takes about an hour and a half, you know, washing the quads and everything else. I get them in, and, you know, you're looking at probably 5-6 hours, you know, depending. And that's me going over everything, you know, my routine is I don't change the oil after every single race. I change them about every 3 races. The oil normally is just as clean as, you know, it goes in at. It's not burn, it's not anything. So, but I will change all three boxes. Or four, yeah, front, rear diff, transmission, and engine oil and filter, about every 3 races.
But wow. You're running the engine oil about 6 hours, maybe 7 hours tops.
Yep, pretty much. And you know, we use in the program that I have going, we use all AMS oil. It's a really good oil. It doesn't. It's one thing about it is it's really nice to where if one of my customers, you know, if I don't see this four-wheeler, you know, there's some customers that I may see it after the break, you know, after snowshoe, they're like, just take it home with you, go over it, everything else like that, make sure we're good to go. And, you know, I'll see it, you know, 2 times a year. With the AMS oil product, it's nice that if they want to change their oil, because I don't know if I should be or not, but I'm a pretty big stickler. Once when I change to a brand of oil, then that's what needs to go in that quad, right? I don't like changing name brands or anything else like that. I keep it with that. So for my customers, it's easy for me to hand them a box. And it has the filter, the O-rings, the crush washer, the right amount of oil, every single thing in it. And it's just easier for me to do it that way. But yeah, about, I would probably say, you know, probably safe to bet about 8 hours on that oil. And, you know, there, and which is not a lot of time on the engine, especially because in that engine, you know, there's no friction disc from clutches like you have in the sport quads and everything that, you know, contaminate the oil. These are just the bottom end. Looks very similar to a car. You know, it's got rod bearings, caps, you know, everything else and that goes on in the bottom end.
What would change that process for you so that you would change the oil sooner?
A mud race.
I was thinking you were going to say that, but I wanted it to come from you.
Yeah, a mud race, man. I don't care if I change the oil. You know, if it's all fresh going into a mud race, it's coming out. It's getting oil. All three, you're all four. So every bit of oil. It seems to be like the rear diff takes the most abuse. That is the one thing that, you know, it's black by the time it comes out, and it doesn't really matter what brand you use. It's getting discolored. And I don't know if it's the straight cut gears in the rear or anything else like that. So, if that has anything to do with the heat.
Do the axles live all year long?
I couldn't tell you, to be honest with you. And it depends on who's riding. I've had some customers that, you know, axles, you know, 2-3 years old, they never break them. Cody, we end up changing his out. We end up changing axles and front differential out every three races. And then, wow. And then I pull the fuel pump. And change out the fuel filter, and I rebuild the bottom of the fuel pump with a new filter and everything else about every three races too.
Is there a issue with the fuel pumps, or is it because you guys are gassing in a muddy, mucky environment?
Yeah, we're gassing in that type of environment, right? And it may be completely sunshining and everything else like that, but all it takes is that one clump of mud coming from a quad, you know, while he's sitting there pitted. To just, you know, get down in there and everything else. Last year, we started this, you know, because we learned, right? After Penton last year, and Penton was one of the worst mud races that we've seen in a long time. And we leave Penton, and Cody, you know, Cody had some issues with the cheek pad at Mason-Dixon. Come through, and I think he started four rows back by the time he got his helmet back on and everything else, and ended up like in third place by the end of the first lap, which was crazy. But right there at the end, he kept on telling me that it was, you know, it was dying. And we couldn't figure it, like, it was like running out of gas. And I'm like, well, there's no way you're running out of gas. And then I went ahead and put a new throttle body on. I put new injectors in it, and I put a new fuel pump on, just, you know, because those are the, you know, the big thing. There was no check engine light coming on or anything else like that. So that was kind of telling me that it was leaning more toward the fuel pump. Pulled the tank, and lo and behold, there was mud all in the bottom of the tank.
So, oh man!
Put in a new fuel pump. Done what we needed to do, and you know everything started running right after that. So it's kind of just one of those things to where, you know, in the program that we run, you know, we keep it always, you know, always looking for ways to improve. And that's just something that we do. It's fueling open the way that we do is part of it. Can't get around it. So I just, it's not that expensive to change the filter or anything else. So.
Right. What's the weakest portion of that machine?
Probably the front differential, to be 100% honest with you.
I wasn't thinking that, but based on some of the things that Cody's told me, I could see how you could say that. Because just bear with me, because I'm not you, but I don't deal with a four-wheel drive. But listening to him talk, when he hits the G out, or the ripple in the trail, or the off camber with the log, if he's in the throttle the wrong way, it can damage that and change his whole race.
Yeah. So yeah, one thing about these pigs is you race them in four wheel drive. That's where they get raced at. You don't click into two wheel drive. You don't do anything else like that. We normally I tape Cody's button down, so that way in no way can he reach up and, you know, click it out. So we keep them in four wheel drive for the most part, you know, maybe going to the line, or, you know, or whenever I get it here, you know, so that way my son can, you know, flip it around and do other things with it. But we do things to the front differential that that help with its longevity. And, you know, some people run what is called an unlocked front diff, and then some people run a locked front diff. A unlocked front diff just means it's almost like the old Honda four-wheeler, the four-wheel drives, right? Whatever wheel has the least amount of resistance on it is the wheel that's going to spin. So it's easier to turn the quad, and, you know, still have a front end pull on it, but you just don't have that front end bite that a lock diff does, because the moment one tire goes to slip, the other one, they both lock in and kick in, you know, to come out of that corner. Yeah, it steers harder whenever everything's locked in, but we, you know, we can remove the visco gel. And that's what, you know, makes it an unlocked diff, or we just keep it all in and, you know, go from there. It's really rider preference on that, what they feel like they want. And then there's 8 ring gear bolts that set on the ring gear that we end up going in and TIG welding. And what that ends up doing is, normally if you don't do that, those bolts decide to back out, and then they hit the baffle on the vent tube. And once when they hit that baffle, it just blows the front end completely apart. You'll have probably that, you know, that big of a hole in the top of that differential, and it's over after that, you know. So, some drawbacks to running an unlocked diff in the front end is, you know, if you lose an axle, then you lose four-wheel drive completely, because, you know, there's no resistance on that axle that's broke, right? So it's able to sit in there and spin. If you have a locked front end, then you keep it together to where you still have somewhat a four-wheel drive, still have, you know, a pull in the front end.
Okay, I get that. What's the strongest part of the machine?
Probably the motor. Those motors are tanks, man. You know, they have their issues on a overheating. But other than that, you know, I've talked to a few people. I've talked to, you know, Robert Smith. He ended up losing a radiator at Snowshoe 1 year and completed the race with no radiator on it. So it never died, never done anything. He said, you know, he could feel going up those ski slopes that it was starting to get tight, you know, it was starting to heat lock. And, but he ended up finishing the race with it. So I would probably say the motor is about the strongest point on that entire machine.
That's pretty cool. So at this point, the Can-Am 1000 is the best 4x4 race quad on the market today.
Yeah, it's about the only one on the market, but yeah, it Need more manufacturers, you know, to come back out with things. Can-Am really, they hit a mark whenever they introduced the Renegade, because it is a pure, you know, it is categorized as a sport 4x4. And really there's no difference. Once when you take off all the plastics, there's no difference in between like your Outlander or your Renegade. The frames are the same. Everything is the same.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool. So I can put racks on it and go hunting.
You could.
Nice. Yes.
Yeah, Can-Am makes a, there's a few aftermarket companies that make a rear rack for the Renegade. So.
It makes me laugh because, you know, that's what you're thinking when you're talking about a 4x4. You're not thinking that this sleek, I mean, you call it a pig, but those are sleek, mean looking race machines.
Oh yeah. Yeah, they are. You know, and you know, you've essentially got, you know, 90 some odd horses, you know, strapped between your legs that you're trying to go. And I think one of my favorite part about racing was coming up to a field section or anything else like that, and you know, you're on a sport quad, you're coming out of the woods, he won't let you pass. Then he looks back and then he tries to race you in a field and you walk by him like he's sitting still. It's pretty funny. They don't like it too much, that's for sure.
I bet not. Put a twist throttle on it.
Oh man, there were a few people that ran twist throttles. Dwight Pollard, Landon runs a twist throttle. They take them off of the Can-Am Spider, you know, the little three wheel thing. And they're an electronic throttle too. And at one point in time, I think somebody told me LW's was a quarter of an inch from no gas to full gas. That's all it took on the twist. And I never rode one with it. I rode a Banshee one time with a twist throttle, and I went back to my thumb throttle after I did that. That thing was crazy.
I'm a twist throttle guy. I was just wondering, you know, if it can be done.
Yeah. They take it off. It's the Spider or the Riker or something like that. But it, you know, it takes some finagling and everything. But yeah, it shares the same. Shares kind of the same ramp rate or, you know, everything as the electronic throttle on the 19s and up.
Excellent. So if I wanted to do performance work, is there motor packages for this machine out there?
So there's different things that you can do. Like, so we'll take my quad, for example. My quad has Maverick 1000 pistons out of the side by side in it, and what that done is that took it from like a 10 to 1 compression ratio that I'm at about a 12.5 to 1 compression ratio out of it. Drawbacks is it starts a lot slower, right? Even on 24 volts, it starts slower, but you got, you know, lower end, you got a little bit more lower end torque. I know B&R does some porting packages to where, I mean, he could build some crazy motors, you know, with his CNC port and everything else like that, to the point to where you can't even hold them. You can't even hold on to them. Like you find yourself fighting it more to keep the front end down than actually, you know, ride the track. So there is that, there's that balance that I think is needed, right? Because I always grew up under the assumption of it's better to have it, not need it, to need it, not have it. And that is where, like, you know, the 850 and the 1000 came into to thing, because I think the 850 was 76 horses, 76 or 78 horses. And then you're looking at, you know, 93 horses, and all of that's at the crank. What they actually do on the dyno, you know, I have no clue. but it's a definite performance advantage, especially in long drawn out field sections between the two. But there's not really any kits or anything that you could buy to do, you know, do what you could piecemeal things together. That's about it.
That's awesome. Hey, Mike, I want to thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with this machine, with me and with the listeners, because it's not a norm for me. I'm a sport quad guy, and talking 4x4s, it's almost a foreign language. I've been blessed to have been involved with some things that allow me to understand it a little better. Yeah. But
the team here at ATV Talk would love your feedback. Please email us at hello@atvtalkpodcast.com. San Diego's Body Evolution and Wellness Center. With over 17 years experience, Dr. Heidi looking out after all your chiropractic needs, and Coach PJ looking out after all your fitness needs. Visit our website, www.bodyevolution.org, or call for an appointment, 619-987-8875. If you're in need of a consultation for your current racing program, a custom ATV, or an industry guest speaker, I have the company for you. Duncan Technologies International Inc. offers host, MC, and guest speaking services at events. Builds custom ATVs for recreational riding or racing around the world. And they offer consulting services for professional teams or individual racers. Send inquiries to DuncanTechInternational@gmail.com or call 619-716-1532 for more information. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, don't forget to share us with your family and friends. The podcast is available on all streaming platforms, and you can find us on social media as ATV Talk Podcast. We're on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, Rumble, and Twitter